up with a name afterwards.
Well, I can edit the recording anyway, so it's all right.
We're
recording now. We're recording.
Okay. Well, welcome to Name Goes Here. where the three of us, we're watching The Expanse, watching an episode, and then what we're going to be like fortnightly, maybe? We're going to watch an episode, talk about it, and that's it. And so Hamish and I, we've watched The Expanse the whole thing through. We've watched it multiple times. Chris is coming to it for the first time. So, I'll talk about my experience of The Expanse. So, I'd heard it was a good show. I tried to watch it. I actually bounced off it a couple of times. I watched the first couple of episodes and I was like, okay, this is good. It's high quality, but this is just like film noir detective in space. And that's good, but you know, I've seen it before. I'll put that down and I'll pick it up later, maybe. Gave it another go, got to the same point. I was like, ah, it's just detective in space, whatever. Came back to it a third time, got all the way to episode 4, and I was like, oh, this is cleverer than that. This is something else. Because I think what it does is, because it does start off as film noir detective in space, which is good in itself, but then it keeps adding layers of, it doesn't change what it is, but it adds layers. There's a layer doing this and there's a layer doing that. And episode 4 for me is where that first turning point. And then season 2, something I mentioned off air with Hamish, is a particular event where I'm like, oh, this is clever. This is something really, really interesting. So, I love The Expanse.
Yeah, they don't show all the cards early on. They don't hold your hand. It is. I don't want to say an acquired taste. That's not quite what I mean. But you've got to make a little bit of effort yourself.
You've got to trust it.
You've got to trust it. What's happening and go with it. Yeah.
Because now when I rewatch those first few episodes, now they're setting up so much stuff that's going to be either important or symbolic later. And it's like when I rewatch the first episode, Lyle, I'm like, oh, it's when he talks about his hat keeping the rain off.
Yeah.
And like,
there's
just so many little things that they're setting up.
Yeah. Oh. And the point is that it doesn't, they haven't started a show and not known where they're going because of the origin of the show. We'll talk about that in a minute because we already have, we'll talk about the origin in a second. But because they knew where they were going with so much of it from the start, there's no wasted stuff. There's nothing that suddenly disappears and doesn't make sense or anything that dead ends or whatever. You know, it's all... I'm not saying every single detail is important. My God, you're going to not get it unless you watch every second 10 times.
Unlike New Trek, it doesn't end each arc with like 50 million ships fighting 50 million other ships and zooming fucking laser beams going between them. And, you know, like, oh, I'll fast forward through this bit, Jesus.
Yeah. There's not a lot of cliche in it. There's a few cliches, but not, you know,
well,
cliche
not,
in a good
no
way.
Cliche, I think. Yeah, they use... Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, a cliche is, you know, a cliche is the sort of hammer or screwdriver of the toolbox, and so it's all they're always there, but it's when they're badly used or
the down on his luck detective who's like, you know, sort of in the system but sort of a bit dodgy. It's like, I mean, that's such a film noir cliche, but they know that they're using that for something, and he's a great, I love Miller.
Miller's
great
character.
He's a very handsome man, very, like, pleasure to look at.
is Miller. Okay, I'm trying to hook into quite a lot here now. Is Miller supposed to be like of Martian origin?
No, Miller's a Belter.
No,
he was born Belter. In Ceres. Where the station is where he was born.
Yeah, that's it. No, I get it now. That's so he's got that thing where he can't have gravity. No, he is. Because they base this in real science, so I'm going to get...
It's quite realistic, a lot of it, yeah.
So, as I understand it, so the Belters... Now, the Belters are on... Is there, like, one or two, like, mining worlds there, right?
Well, they're all over the place in the belt. The asteroid belt.
The asteroid belt that's, like, out, sort of... Is it beyond...
Beyond Mars. Between Mars and Jupiter, there's an asteroid belt, yeah.
Because the outer people, the outer ones... the outer planetary terrorist group,
OPA.
That's the one. Yeah. So the Belters are the asteroid belt is basically the division between the. So we don't know much about the the belt, the, oh my god, I'm gonna, this is gonna start, right.
It's
great, I love it.
Yeah, it's it. Well, can I give a wee,
oh yeah, sorry, yeah,
a little but just basically the introduction you see at the start of the first episode kind of explains the broad strokes. There are three factions, sort of broad factions, in the galaxy, in the solar system. There's Earth and the Moon, who are the United Nations. Mm-hmm. And obviously that's like first humans. Then there's Mars, who have their own independence, and they're trying to terraform Mars, and they've got colonies there.
Mars is,
and they're the symbolically,
if not in actual fact, like Mars is kind of like the kind of the Soviet Union, kind of China. There's definitely a strong Chinese vibe.
Yeah,
like,
so,
like,
yeah,
like the political unity, one cause.
Exactly.
Yeah, Mars is exactly like that. Yeah.
Planned economy, planned society. It's got the vibe of, yeah.
Yeah, and they're all very. It doesn't come until series two. We see a lot more Martian stuff, but they are very, yeah, they're very dedicated to Mars. All the sort of military and everything, the scientists and stuff. And then you've got then you've got everybody else basically, which is all the belt, the asteroid belt, and there's colonies on moons of the outer planets, because obviously the outer planets are all gas giants, so there's no colonies on gas giant. But there are other colonies and things out there, and that's where, you know, the sort of Wild West starts, as it were, in terms of the solar system. So
is that the moons of Saturn, is there stuff going on there?
Yes, some of them, but you won't see much of that until series two.
But
they're part of the outer planets.
That's the outer planets, okay. Yeah. Now, this is the other thing, is the belters, so everybody that's not born, they call everybody else inner. So everybody from inside the asteroid belt is inner. So that's, they treat, a lot of people in the belt just treat Martians and humans as all the same. You know, they're basically the enemy. But the important thing to know, and I don't know how well that comes across in the first episode, so probably doesn't, but I'm not making a huge spoiler here by saying that the Belters are not really one unified people.
Because
large stations and people on call.
Another aspect of the dynamic, I would say, like broadly, this isn't, you don't look too hard at this.
Oh, yeah,
broadly,
yeah, same here, yeah, same
like Earth, late capitalism, Mars, state socialism, and the outer planets, anarchism, essentially.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. So the outer planets is not the asteroid belt. That's, the outer planets are like,
it includes the asteroid
includes
belt.
The asteroid. Everything from the asteroid belt outwards is the outer planet. The only reason it's got OPA in the name of the organization, but they are actually splintered as well. It's the Outer Planets Alliance, but they're not a government as such.
I love that they use the anarchist.
So that would be like how, like Antifa might be described, where they say, well, there's lots of Antifas about, but they're not connected or organized. They're just
kind of
following a
sort
vague
of like that,
directional cause. I'm getting a vibe that because of the air and ice and stuff, is that what they're mining so I'm kind of getting, is that a bit like the gold rush or like prospectors?
It's got a Wild West thing going on.
Things, well, it does mention it in the first episode that there's an agitator doing a talk on a public causeway.
Talking about
the OPA, and he says that Ceres was once covered in ice, so they had enough water there for their entire society.
He says, like, we had enough water for like 10,000 years.
Happened was Earth and Mars, well, Mars obviously needs imported water. Earth probably polluted all the water. So they basically went to the outer planets and took everything from the asteroid belt and took everything from it, took all the resources. And it's that kind of like colonial gold rush.
It's a class thing as well. Like,
definitely.
The class dichotomy they set up is a bit, you know, because there's essentially a lumpen proletariat on Earth. You'll find out about later, but yeah, you got the sort of privileged classes on Earth and Mars, and then, you know, the workers. on the. Can I just talk about that sort of establishing shot of it's series, right? The yeah,
that's the first station
you
we
get,
see. Yeah.
You get that shot with the drone flying through the station. So you see, the class division on well,
even in the station, yeah,
yeah. It flies through. You see the privileged areas. You see the areas where the poor people live. So it does that while that speech is going on. So you're seeing what this place is, what the structure of it is, what it looks like, how it functions, and you're hearing like what it's like to live there from the dude giving the speech. And that's such a great fucking way to start that. It's not the start of the show, but your introduction to series, because you learn without being sort of just, you know, spoon-fed exposition. You're given the structure of this place and how it works, and it's like so well done. So nice.
That's what I mean by it's not, you know, it's not holding your hand, and it's not there's not loads of exposition dumps. Things, and that's why it is a bit difficult to get into, I think, until you've seen a few episodes, because there's a lot of people. There's three sort of segments of humanity being introduced to you right away, and there's the subdivisions within, you know, the sort of
you showed so many situations and so many characters, like how the hell am I going to keep track of all this? But the show does a great job of
it comes together so well.
We were talking a little bit before Chris got here about even the characters on the Canterbury, like Hamish and I were saying, like you only meet them for like a couple of minutes each, but they're so well characterized, like you know who each of those
people. you get a sense of them being different people, not just a crew. It's not like, as you said, go with the Star Trek comparison, they're not just background people on the bridge of the ship. They've all got, even with just a couple of lines, they've got personalities, they've got, you know, different... Yeah.
The captain with his reasons. Cat.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. No, there's all these little details.
He's weird about his cats. It's just great.
So I got a question about that. So the guy, the bald guy, is he the captain?
No, that's the second in command.
He's the second in command.
Yeah, he's the XO.
He's the XO,
but then he goes mad.
He certainly does.
And then, so then the other character, the younger main Commander Shepard kind of guy, I think.
Shepard? I'm sorry, I don't get the reference.
Oh, that's a Mass Effect.
Which
came first, this Expanse or Mass Effect? Because there's some
Mass Effect came first. There's a bit of Mass Effect in there for sure. It's better than Mass Effect by a zillion miles, but there is a bit of Mass Effect in there for sure.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I definitely noticed, but I don't know, because like Mass Effect borrows from like everything as well.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So it's quite. I see a lot of like overlap. I do see a lot of like. Is it 2015? Is that when it comes out?
Oh, I don't know.
Good question.
Is somebody doing that?
I'll let Chris do, because I don't want to mess up the recording.
Hold on,
that's
fine.
Okay, here we go.
Of course, I've got another monitor I should look at.
You got
2015 to 2022. 9.4 stars on IMDb.
I love that you looked that up now rather than before you started watching. Can I just talk about an event? Can I talk about one of the events on the Canterbury? This is not clever, but the zero G sex that I think of, right? First of all, that looks great. Second of all, right? Okay, I've been in an intimate situation with a lady, believe it or not. she was a top, and she came down a bit too hard at a scanty angle, and bent my penis. And then it bled out of its hole for quite a while afterwards.
Ouch.
And that bit where they're having zero G sex, and then the gravity comes on because they're accelerating.
And
she comes down so hard on him every time. Yeah. Every time I
makes your eyes water.
Yeah. I don't know. Zero G gravity sounds like a lot of work, to be honest.
Yeah, I love that it doesn't do the Star... I mean, I get why they do it in Star Trek. It doesn't do the we've got artificial gravity thing. Like, they only have gravity. Mm. The ships are arranged sort of like tower blocks for the most part, and they only have gravity while they're accelerating. So if they stop accelerating, zero G. And I love that so much. I also love... Sorry, this is all a bit like film study stuff. The very opening bit where there's the ice block and it cuts that dude's arm off, and so you get to see that like this is a dangerous job, and then you meet him a bit later on where he's like, oh, you can get this kind of arm if you've been working for this long. The inners have got a gel that would replicate your arm, but we've just got like artificial arms. Just they set up so much without, again, like you say, without patronizing you or spoon feeding.
Yeah, and it's teaching you about the class system throughout this factions.
Like, so much fiction fails to fails to sort of have an economy in it. Mm. I think Lord of the Rings is the perfect. There's no economy in Lord of the Rings whatsoever. No. People get stuff.
So when he's in that conversation, he's talking about. So he's got his arm off, and they're talking about. Well, you can't get that. And doesn't he say, I'd rather have a fake one?
Yeah, I'd rather have a built-in made fake than the Inner's magic gel. That's what he's
saying. So is this a little bit like them saying, oh, I'd rather have my rusty old pickup truck that always starts when I put the key in rather than one of those dang fangled cyber trucks or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah, basically.
It's pride. You know, he's got cultural pride in where he comes from. And But I would say it's not quite like the example you set up is more sort of a reactionary resentment, whereas this
a distrust from the other side of the.
It's more well, it's fuck those guys oppress us. I'm not taking their shit.
Basically, yeah.
So
they could grow him another arm if he. Well, they could. They wouldn't grow him one, but yeah, but they could do it. They could do it for somebody else, but you know, it's a sort of class thing, rather than.
Is it also a bit?
Certain technologies, you know.
Yeah, is it a bit like? Organic in that way that he like it is the technology of growing it back in any way distrusted like how
I don't
how
know if we ever would... explore that really
well, oh, okay
we do much I know Chris you're not hugely spoiler averse anybody watching this there's gonna be spoilers in this we're gonna try not to spoil I'm not gonna spoil anything plotty for you I'm not gonna spoil any big events but we do get to see the bio gel later.
I'm trying to remember. I've just remembered why we do have I'll shut up because this is.
I mean, I certainly like. I'm not an averse to spoilers. Like, if there's like a big like red wedding kind of thing, that's different. But like, if I don't know who a faction, I'll just do a Google search to make sure because I sort of assume. I don't know whether or not to know that, and I don't know if that's going to ruin it for me. I hope it doesn't.
It's like... ask us rather than search, I think, because we will avoid anything that's significant for sure. I will say you just mentioned Game of Thrones briefly. I won't go too far, but I believe the writer, the two writers of this, but I think the more writery writer of this, I think he was in a writers group with George R. R. Martin. Yeah, and I think they're friends. I might be overstating that, but yeah, there's certainly a connection there.
Yeah, I suppose it's a good point where we could to bring in the origin of this whole thing, actually, before we forget, is originally what is now the TV show The Expanse and a bunch of books by James S. A. Corey. It's actually two people. That's a pen name of two people together. But the original thing was a role-playing game. Or at least a role-playing game background, a scenario. You know, they created a future solar system backing. And that's why there's so many things that are just... that might seem small now, but they come back later. Not because of clever, clever plotting from the very start, but just because this solar system exists in so many notes. And what happened was, you know, not the events of the game, but you know there might be some. I'm not sure, but the structure was all there. So when they started writing the books, you know, they had the entire background. It's like they'd written the show Bible already, and they didn't have to contradict or go back or anything because it was all laid out. And then the books came along because they decided to write them, you know, write stories about it. Rather than play a game, and then the show came along, and ironically now there is an Expanse role-playing game, tabletop role-playing game, which I think is based on a different engine from whatever they were using as well, which is even weirder. but the source material is all laid out right from the start. You know, the level of technology, the level of realism, the factions, the social structure and hierarchy of it all is all there from the very start, and that's why is the like that little thing Drew said about the little drone that was flying through the station and goes through like the scummy bits, and then to this bit where there's gardens on a space station and stuff. You know, this all just it just sets all up beautifully.
And that's why I think that's why it's such a cohesive universe they've created. Like they, like you say, they never have to sort of retcon anything and go, oh, we didn't quite think that through. This is how it is really. It's just everything. It's everything perfect. All the characters and their origins. That's the thing. Even if you don't hear about them directly, you feel like these characters came from somewhere, and they have their views and you know peculiarities for reasons rather than just like they are that thing arbitrarily.
Everybody. I mean, the crew. I'm not sure how spoilery to be. Can I be spoilery about the end of the first episode? The big thing.
I mean, I've got ideas.
It's hard to not move past that because it's the whole first episode.
Yeah, I don't know. I can.
I know. I've got a way to put it. Yeah. Hang on. I've just thought of a way to put it. So you've got in one part of the story, you've got a group of people crewing together, and forming like a little mini crew. And those people are who we learn more about. You know, we learn so much more about them as the series goes on. And they're not one-dimensional and everything, you know, especially like Amos. And
there's characters where... There's two particular characters I'm going to mention where you start... tell me sharp if it feels too spoilery for you, Chris. But Amos and Avicerella, first episode, I was like, oh, they're dicks. Amos, I just thought, oh, he's a bit rude, a bit of an arsehole. And Avicerella, I was like, she's torturing a man like she is irredeemable. She is a bad character and I fucking hate her. And by the end of the show, I'm like, she's so great. I love her so much.
Yeah.
And Amos, I won't say anything specific, but the things you learn about Amos, there's episodes where he just gives a single line, and because you know what's behind it, I just cry. He's such a lovable character.
There's little details that he just throws in to the conversation. He doesn't say much anyway, Amos. You know, but whatever he says, he means.
So, can I ask Chris, like, how did you, when you saw Avicerella torturing that belt, she's torturing the belter hanging up in you know, gravity that he's not used to. How'd you feel about that?
So, I see, part of it is I don't know what it's like to have my body under those conditions. Now, you get the initial, like, hit of it, right? Like, and it's like, it looks like this guy's, like, strapped to a rack or something. He's a belter from the outer planetary.
So he didn't grow up in gravity and all that sort of thing.
And
they basically just got him up on hooks. There's just two hooks under his elbows.
That's the thing.
It looks so painful.
It looks painful, but I didn't know whether or not
grown up in Earth gravity that would be painful.
Yeah, hanging up by your armpits is probably already a painful thing, never mind this, you know.
Yeah, but it's not like as painful as like being impaled to a wall. I've not tested this hypothesis, so I don't but I don't know whether or not it was supposed to, like, maybe a little bit supposed to be a bait and switch. And also I don't know what the difference is. Yeah, like, so it might just be, I know that you were supposed to initially think it was torture, but then were you supposed to go, oh, he's just being held up, as it were? I don't know if
I think you get from dialogue, he's been there for 10 hours hanging on.
Yeah.
And she says at the end of that scene, you know, give him another, you know, she doesn't get the answer she wants from him, give him another 10 hours.
Yeah.
So no, it is torture.
I mean, I thought this was a little bit where the exposition, like, you know, it's a first episode because it's like, there is such that, like, and it's so much of that time as well, that, like, I mean, it's not that long ago, but like, where it's like, oh, cheeky kid throws the ball, and then this is like this immediate, okay, so this is the clear first impression. You're supposed to think she's kind of got this like hard edge, but actually is quite playful, kind of like, oh, she's a good person, but she puts on a front. Like, it's the little, like, it's the
juxtaposition,
but also the little microcosm of a story to open it up. Like, it's a bit of bang. It is show, don't tell, but it's like, but show it quickly. And that felt a little bit first episode-y for me. But
I agree with that. Yeah, that is very,
Well, if I could say, the thing we were talking about before we started recording, Drew and I were talking about, and I said that if you watch the first episode of the first series and the first episode of the second series, you think Avasarala has been replaced in some way, but it's not. It all makes sense. It works from that point to that point. Pure character building, story affects things.
It's not character, because often things will do. I mean, again, New Trek is very guilty of this. Just changing people's characters in a way that doesn't really make sense in terms of what they have experienced. But Avasarala changes because she learns new things.
Exactly.
She meets people, she learns things, and that changes her output. And her fundamental... it's got a very minor spoiler. So she starts off like, Earth has to come first. We defend Earth. We will go to any lengths to defend Earth from people who want to harm Earth.
The elusive man.
Sorry?
The elusive man.
Is that... What's that from?
Mass Effect 2.
That's President Bartlett in Mass Effect.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
And then later on, she expands that to be anything for humanity. I will say that much.
Yeah, that's a minor. Yeah, that's
and okay. Spoiler. So when you say anything for humanity, you mean the human beings, as in what we the physical.
Her notion of who is included in the group that I'm in expands as she meets
people. Okay, yeah. Okay, yeah.
That's a bit too much. I wish I hadn't said that. That's a bit too much, I think. But yeah.
But it's all organic. It all happens organically with the story and the act. I mean, that's another thing. Yeah, every actor.
I think she's an Iranian actress, right?
Yeah, she's like you say, part Iranian, part something else.
They don't flatten the accents out. They don't say everybody from this place has got this kind of accent. We see a variety of accents, and that's nice as well. Which you mentioned.
Yes, people from Earth have got different accents themselves. People in the Belt have got this weird mix of accents and dialects and stuff, but they all understand each other and. You know.
Yeah, I can kind of see that they do, like, I mean, there's that Indian guy with a Texan accent, like a real Southern kind of guy. Like,
Alex. Yeah.
Is it so? Like, it's 200 years in the future, right? Is that have I got that right?
Yeah, more or less. Yeah.
And you've got the prospectors over there in the Outer Belt, but they're going to be from all over originally from Earth. A long time ago, no, 200 years ago. So that's only like 8 generations.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to have all, but because it's prospecting, you've got, it's a bit like, colonialism, isn't it? Where like a whole bunch of races just sort of, because the common thread.
It's colonialism without the sort of uncomfortableness of having people already where you're going.
Yeah.
There's actually, no people there to start with.
Actually, there's that's interesting because, and I hope I don't make a fool of myself by stating some wrong facts here, but I was watching with subtitles on because with something like sci-fi, it helps with the names, you know, and it showed where they were dipping into, and the subtitles said Belta Creole.
That's a Belta Creole, they call it. Yep.
Belta Creole. Now, that is the Creole. That's what they speak on Mauritius, which.
Well, no, a Creole is Creole. Just means a blending of languages.
Yeah, it's like not a specific language.
Yeah, it's not a particular.
Okay.
Because
the thing is with Mauritius, of course, is that that was colonized by a whole different bunch of people. But am I right in thinking that there wasn't an indigenous population there?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah,
that's it. That's so you've got, so in Mauritius you've got like Mauritius Hindi, which is like where the Indians go. You've got Mauritius African. You got Mauritius. There's a French. There's Mauritius French. I feel like I might be missing it, but it's very. It's quite the melting pot, but also with internal factions within the.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, there's a lot of factions because of the various different.
Mm-hmm. With the origins, the historical origins. Yeah.
And obviously, I can't remember whether this is in episode one, but at some point on series, you see that the the trains that go around, the sort of the London Underground of series, the announcements are in English and Mandarin. So you get the sense that the big cultures, the big languages, it was English, Mandarin, and then in Belter. I was saying earlier, I think there's like when they say Sasake, that sounds very French to me. I don't know.
It's got French.
Yeah. So it's like it's a melting pot. Yeah. So it's a bunch of people going to the asteroid from all different places, speaking all different languages, and needing to communicate with each other. Yeah.
Okay. And with people, have we seen much from people of Mars?
Mm-mm.
Which part?
Not a lot.
So I was going to say about the cowboy stuff with Alex, because you're talking about the colonialism. So you can imagine, and this is all me sort of filling stuff in my head, but I think it's there. When the settlers first went to Mars, they're thinking of themselves a bit like, you know, this is the new frontier. This is like the old West.
Yep.
So you can imagine that culturally they would have developed an interest in like cowboy stuff. And later on, when you see Mars, you see there's a bit of that. Alex is a Martian, and so he just loves cowboy stuff. So he talks like a cowboy. I love that as a little detail in a sci-fi thing. That's unusual. You see it a couple times, but it's a nice idea that he just likes this thing. You know, it's probably like 50s cowboy stuff, where it's, you know, the non-problematized, you know, not thinking about the colonialism too much kind of cowboy. Mm.
But cowboy stuff and space stuff, actually, that's quite... You see that
a common
pop
trope.
Up in all kinds of... Yeah, yeah,
well, you got Firefly. Like,
Firefly.
That's exactly...
you got, like, Borderlands. You've got, like, even Star Wars. Like, all of this stuff borrows from...
Star Trek. A lot of TOS, yeah. Star Trek. That was you know, the sheriff of the town in space kind of thing. There's not all of it, but some of it was that, for sure.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, Red Dwarf parodies a lot of it.
There's an episode of TOS where... I can't remember the details, but Kirk goes down to a planet and they're a bit chaotic or something. So he reads them the US Constitution to civilize them. I love that.
No comment.
Yeah. Yeah. So, we need a Supreme Court. Okay.
Right. Is there any other bits? I'm just trying to work out what I've seen now.
Yeah, I mean, just to give you spoiler free, this is just, you know, you can work all this out from the first episode. But Alex is from Mars. Holden, the one you say is the captain type guy. Holden is from Earth. I'm not going to say anything else about them because there's more things you'll learn. But that's the basic.
I think you can say about Naomi.
Naomi and Amos are from the Belt. Oh, sorry, Naomi's from the Belt. Amos isn't. Amos is Earth.
Amos is mysterious, let's say.
Yeah, been mysterious for a long time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, it's not really... from what we've got in the story, it's not fair to say he's from anywhere, is it? Really? Because I'll leave that. You'll discover more about Amos as we go on. But he's basically dedicated to Naomi. He's, you know, I don't know.
But, you know, everybody in the Belt is, you know, previously from somewhere. So there's a bit of, like with Holden, Shepherd, as you're calling him. Like there's a bit, Shepherd's a woman to me, which is, but anyway.
I know what you mean, yeah.
There are tensions between, there are obvious, you know, you see them sometimes, there's tensions between people in the Belt who are from Earth, Mars, versus people who are in the Belt who, you know, whose parents were from the Belt. There's tensions there, but there's also sort of like a common cause. They will accept people so long as, you know, you're on our side.
The Belt's very much like that, but that's why it's also very... sort of fractured as well, but the police officers, that's a good example. So Miller is a Belter. He's from Ceres. He's only from Ceres, so he is an actual Belter. But the people, because he's a cop, the people call him Wellwaller at one point.
Which is
a traitor to the people. Yeah. Whereas his partner, quite a new partner, we sort of get the information as we are. I forgot his name. Oh no! Hopefully, Drew will remember that guy's name.
Yeah, I can't remember
his name. No! It's the partner is from Earth. You know, he's like of Earth. He's not lived in the Belt for a long time. He just takes the job as a cop on Ceres. Mm-hmm. Those two are you know both sort of. Ostracized slightly by the Belters because they're police officers rather than
I think you see that in the episode that they've got sort of different, you know, values and expectations. I can't remember the character whose name we can't remember. He's a little bit idealistic. He's like,
yeah,
I'm going to get along with these people. I'm going to learn their language. Mm. Whereas Miller, you know, he's a bit more jaded. You know, he's taking bribes from the filter dude. But you can see he's also got a breaking point. Like when people start suffering because of it, then he goes and throws the dude in the airlock. Yep. And,
so he's the he's obviously film noir guy, right? Because well, see, I thought when you were talking about the hat, I thought that basically was just like, I'm the film noir guy because he's
That. But it also becomes textually a bit more texturally a bit more than that.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It's got
several meanings, really, the hat, isn't it?
I know
it's so small. It doesn't really particularly go anywhere specific, but I just love it when the dude asks him, why do you wear that hat? And he says, keeps the rain off my head. He's in a space station. There's no weather. He's indoors his whole life. And he's like, it keeps the rain off my head.
That's not like a reference to a film noir film, is it?
Not that possibly, I'm aware of, but it could be.
I don't know about it, but it comes up later in little, like this isn't a spoiler, you know, there's a bit where there is water dripping and it does keep his head dry.
That's Chekhov's
just drip. Yeah, it's just love. There's more with the hat. It's none of it particularly deep, but
don't worry about you missing any of it, but you know, you'll see little references.
Him just saying offhandedly, it keeps the rain off my head, is like, that's his entire character.
That sums up Miller. Yeah,
love it. I absolutely adore that line.
Is there Blade Runner sort of like stuff? Oh, yeah. I'm getting
I'd say Miller's got a bit of a feeling of that. Yeah, not entirely.
Not in terms of the hardcore cyberpunk. There's, you know, there's no synthetics or anything like that. But no. In terms of the sort of, not quite pessimistic, but you know, dirty view of the future. Mm, it's not Star Trek.
Yeah,
I mean, he is. He's obviously the Max Bullitt or Jake Bullitt or whatever. Like he's the cop that he cuts through all the red tape. You know, he doesn't.
Another line that again sums all that up is when somebody says something, I can't remember, but he says, there's no laws on series, just cops.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's it. Yeah. Actually, I felt that was a bit heavy handed, if I'm honest.
It's a little bit heavy handed, but it tells you what you need to know.
And also why both of the policemen are disrespected, regardless of the fact that one of them's a Billet and one of them's an Earther. Mm. You know, it's like, the police are almost like a different faction to everybody else, you know, because they're private cops as well.
So there was definitely something I know that I'm going to know more about, which is the mining corporations, right? Now this is definitely going to be I'm getting sort of Fallout vibes from this. There's shady corporate shit going on, obviously.
I think you've picked it up from a slightly the wrong angle, but you've definitely got your scent now. You're definitely on the right scent.
I
think what you're thinking, what they do is better than that.
It's not as sort of straightforward, well-worn as you might think it is.
Okay, because in my head, oh my god, I'm making another weird reference where this is like, have you played Grand Theft Auto San Andreas?
Yes.
Sorry.
So basically the antagonists in the show, in the TV series, are these cops, and these cops, they're getting the gangs to fight each other. And then sort of like, or like they're profiting off of pitting the gangs against each other.
Right.
And obviously there's lots of politics. My thought is the corporations like causing war so that they can sell guns or something to that effect. Not really.
I would, again, what Hamish said, it's not as well-worn as that. There's definitely, you know, corporation evil. That, you know, you can't have a modern thing without that because corporations are evil.
It's a fact of life at
not,
this point.
Not, in a way, it's very obvious. I'm reluctant to say too much.
Yeah, because we don't want to spoil something that basically builds over the whole series.
Is it like? you know that meme of, and I told you about this, the meme of Rupert Murdoch, and he's and you've got the white and the white working class man and the black working class man, right? Or like the who's, and then the Rupert Murdoch guy, he's saying to the working class man with Rupert Murdoch's got a plate full of biscuits. The working class white man has one biscuit, and then the immigrant working class man has no biscuits. And then Rupert Murdoch is saying to the white working class man, that foreigner's trying to take your biscuit. That's that's kind of what I'm thinking of. Is I might be wrong.
That's always in there, but it's that's the fabric of the world. That is just a reality of this world.
Well, that's just how the world works, isn't it?
Like, I guess that's never the central focus. The politics stuff, I would say. I mean, the show is a very political show at times, but the politics is more geopolitics, as we'd call it. It's beyond that now, obviously, because they're in space. But it's the politics is geopolitics, and then you've got the class tensions for sure, which are explored but never really the central. There's moments when it's central, but
it becomes
it's not
important, but it's not. It's not the. It's there's so much happens that you don't expect, and it does things in such a clever way that we're trying really hard not to say.
There's a particular bit in season two where I was like, this has become something I wasn't expecting, and I fucking love it.
I know what you mean.
Is there a whole society of people that live on places like Ceres? And sort of like corporate towns almost.
Yeah.
Is it a bit like that?
It's like old West company towns.
Towns, that's the word. And is it a bit like the modern equivalent of that? Well, where the oil, you know, like with oil and company towns with.
Mining usually in the old, it was mining towns where. Mm. So for anybody who doesn't know, a company town back in colonial era was a town that was owned by a corporation. All the people who worked for the corporation also lived in the town. They lived in town housing. They went to shops owned by the corporation. So basically they were paid wages, and then all the wages went back to the corporation. And I think in certain circumstances, you know, you always ended up owing more than you got paid in wages.
It was
slavery without the
it was an indenturement without being called slavery.
Well, they use the term slaves in the beginning on Ceres with the drone.
He says that the guy doing the speech in the walkway does that.
Do people go to Ceres as a way of escaping Earth? I kind of feel like that's a vibe.
I mean, with the cop, Miller's cop partner, clearly. Again, he's not a super well explored character, but that's the vibe you get from him, right? He's escaping from something on Earth. James Holden, Shepherd. And also, you know, the XO who goes space mad. And then I will not say very much, but Julie Mao, who's, you know, the character at the very beginning who's locked in a container and then she busts her way out. She's an Earther. I'll say that she's an Earther. But one thing I loved about that scene is the zero G hair effect. Which just looks beautiful, and it's clearly very expensive, because I think the next time you see her, she ties her hair up.
I noticed that. I definitely noticed that. I thought this is the bit where the budget runs out, you know, like, I'll tie the hair up.
Was like, let's do something visually impressive, because it is very visually impressive and very beautiful.
The whole
like,
show the is without it looking like, oh, here's where we spent the money either. It's all very natural looking, and you kind of use, you know,
because it is a very it's a somewhat grim view of the future. But for me, as somebody who very much loves Star Trek, it's got that. I think it's the closest you can do to Star Trek in the world we live in now, in the sense that you still, a little bit spoilery, but you still get this crew of people who have particular competencies, and they solve problems with good intentions. They solve problems by working together and talking things out and working out how to address the problem. It's got that aspect of Star Trek to it. It's got the sort of the ensemble cast of characters who you know you love them all in different ways, and they all work together to solve problems. And it's got a little bit of competency porn, but not quite to the extent that Star Trek does. So I think it's it gets closer to being a modern view of Star Trek than modern Star Trek does for me, by far.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, that's a fair comparison, or a fair analogy.
Yeah. How much am I supposed to know about that opening scene?
Well, if you've only seen the first episode, pretty much nothing. It takes
very briefly, I was saying to Hamish before you joined, it took me 3 watches through to get a full grasp on exactly what's happening there. You get the gist, and that's all you need. But the specifics of it were...
I don't even know if I get the gist, if I'm honest.
No, not yet. No, not yet. But with one watch through of subsequent episodes, you'll get enough, yeah.
I'm getting Alien vibes. Sorry, I can't watch sci-fi without comparing it to every other thing I've seen.
Well, that's it. Yeah.
Well,
something terrifies her, you know. You only get a glimpse of what it is. And actually, I know the show, and even watching that first scene where Julie sees something happening in the engine room, I'm not sure if that's one of the things we see later again, or if it's something... Yeah, I can't really say too much because it'll spoil something. But I wish I'd remembered to speak to Drew about this off before Chris was there. Because
I'll say this as context. There's one of the two people who make up the author of the books, and they're very the author is very heavily involved in the show as well, which I think is one of the reasons why it's so good. He does a YouTube channel with the character who plays, with the actor who plays Amos. And they talk about, so this is the author, and they talk about all the sort of media franchises that they love, TV, mostly movies. It's the movies that they love. And that's, if you've watched the show, if you watch that, it's very telling. It's like, oh, this is the X episode, this is the Y episode. Alien is certainly in there. I'll say that much.
yeah, you can't escape the James Cameron-ness of a lot of it. But yeah, I don't know whether to just say this out or not. I mean, it's not a spoiler to you because you've seen it. So yeah, sorry, you've seen this episode. What Julie sees in the engine room is this all blue sparkling stuff and big veins of blue stuff shining all through the engine room. And she sees what looks like a body coming in and out of it.
Oh, yeah. The weird, like, what's with the head? Is it a skull or something?
Well, I've seen it so many times I still couldn't tell you exactly what's going on there because I have other knowledge, unfortunately, which kind of colours that. And I don't, I'm definitely not telling you that because it's a bit further on, but quite a bit further on. But I'm not sure what Julie saw, and we see it.
This is another way in which this show is very good, very, very tightly engineered. Is there's all these, especially in episode one, and well, the first few episodes of season one, you're shown so many disparate things. And of course, they all come together. They all tie together. Mm-hmm. But they tie together so fucking satisfyingly. When certain characters... I mean, it's not a spoiler to say that certain characters are going to meet up at certain points, but the ways in which they meet up is just so incredibly satisfying.
Yes. Yeah, it's none of this. They're not shoehorning things together. They're not skipping anything and saying, oh, and then later. It all just weaves beautifully.
Turned up, everybody's there. I'm thinking of... There's a little thing that happens in a lobby, Hamish, that I... Where, yeah.
Yeah. Love it. Yeah. Love it. Yeah. There's everything that happens makes sense. Every change to a character's viewpoint or actions makes sense. There's no, and I think this is something that, yeah. Oh, sorry, I'm getting excited now. One of the things that this has nothing to do with the show specifically, but I think that the role playing game origins of it help this a lot. That one of the reasons role-playing games exist, tabletop role-playing games especially, I think, is because you'll watch a film or a TV show or read a book and you're like, that's stupid, they wouldn't do that. Why would they go into that room when they know there's something that... And I think that's the one of the absolute essences of role-playing games is that people think they know better than the characters. So when they're playing the characters, they should do the right thing. It doesn't. If you ever play a role-playing game, you know it goes all to hell all the time.
I mean, the best example of this, and I think it's something you don't see in a show like this very often, is there's moments when particular characters are like, I see why you want to do that, and I see why you're going after that, but I want to go and do this other thing. I disagree with that being the priority. I want to go and do this other thing. So, you know, bye, see you later. And you don't see that in shows very often. It's usually, you know, they're a whole. It's one person writing it, and they're thinking of, you know, this group as a whole.
As a whole thing, yeah.
Because it's come from a role-playing thing, characters can disagree with each other in terms of where they go, plot-wise, which is lovely.
I think the whole role-playing game origin of it has made it something completely different.
There's definitely things I've seen where that's been a weakness. It's a little bit too, again, I mentioned this, but like it's a little bit too, this feels like watching a role-playing session. But with with The Expanse, I think they blend it well. They keep that overarching, you know, authored idea of what's happening with the freedom of characters can be a little bit more dynamic and a little bit more, what's the word for operating on your own?
Autonomous.
Autonomous, yeah.
All right, okay.
That's what I was thinking, yeah.
I was going to say, given them agency.
Yeah.
With the last bit, I want to make sure I know what I think I saw happened. Because that was a little bit where I felt like, so they're off mine.
They're truckers, basically.
Yeah. Truckers. Mm. Oh yeah, they're carting the expensive cargo, the air and stuff. And is there a rule that, like, if they get a distress signal, they've got to help, like on the high seas?
Yeah, that's
a bit punky in that if they don't, the corporation is liable.
And I think isn't there a rule on the high seas that if someone's like stranded or whatever, you've got to at least.
Well, the thing is, it affects everybody the same, and that's you know, the self-preservation element of it is why it works with with sailors. You know, why there is a sort of maritime.
If I was in that situation, I would want somebody to come for me.
Exactly. Therefore. Yeah, it doesn't matter what country you're from or what, you know, you're a ship in distress. People should help. Yeah,
but they were talking about, so they use the term pirate bait. So is it like sometimes they leave traps?
Yes, sometimes pirates will make it look like there's somebody in the street. Again, just like the old, you know, the old high seas.
And I think that's what you get from this situation without them quite explicitly saying it, is like this is more likely to be a trap than to be anybody genuinely.
They're sort of, it's a bit of confirmation bias. It's like, they're like, look, you know, it's a good chance. They're sort of leaning into that. Oh, it may be too dangerous. The safest thing is just to ignore it. Mm.
Yeah.
When really, and then do they hear the guy's looking at the logs? Is it the logs or something?
Holden goes back into the logs and retrieves the message and then hears the
recycled in and.
This is subjective, I think, but to me, I read like that was his intention all along.
Oh, right. I never thought of that way.
I don't believe he ever had any intention whatsoever of leaving that person's friend.
Otherwise, he would have emptied the recycle bin.
Which makes sense for Holden's character. Yeah. Which makes sense for Holden's character. Yeah. Yeah. So maybe he did.
Okay.
So in the face of the crew and the captain, I think he went along with the captain's idea. But I never, see, there you go. I've watched it so many times and I never really clicked with that maybe meant that all along.
Because the way I read it was that, like, he heard a voice and that sort of was like, that kind of changed it. It was like, oh, we can't really ignore that. It's a little bit like not knowing how the sausage is made a little bit. Like, it's like, the voice makes it real. It makes it look like,
Once he hears
out of mind, and then it sort of comes into
person,
my thought.
There's a real person at the end of this.
Yeah, but I don't know.
The intention was in the moment when he's there and he's acting XO. He's like, captain's given his order, and what he's doing there is like, I'm going to think about. I'm not comfortable with this, but if I make a fuss now, it's going to be too obvious. Mm. I'm going to go and think about this. And then, you know, later on, he's like, okay, I'm going to check these logs and see how likely it is that, you know, and then, like you say, he hears the voice and that's what pushes him over the edge. I think, he always...
That would explain why he, like, because they were kind of setting him up to be like a little bit maverick, right? And then he has this turnabout character moment where he's like, actually, he's helping the captain pull rank. And it's like, and I thought that was a bit weird. Like, it felt out of place. But as you say... If he meant to do that all along, go into the recycle bin, pull out the logs and actually have a look, then that actually lines it that lines up a lot more satisfyingly than that explains that weirdness in the moment.
That's what I'm saying. It just when Drew said that, it's like, oh yeah, that kind of clicks better than wondering if he just got a conscience.
Knowing what we know about Holman, having watched the whole thing, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever that he would just be like, yeah, fuck him.
Yeah, that's true. That's absolutely true, yeah. Holden is definitely the conscience. He's, you know, the conscience of everything.
Yeah, yeah. To a fault.
To a fault, exactly. Yeah.
Like, well, like, dangerously.
Obviously, in the first episode, it causes... Where would it have gone? It's hard to tell.
He's talking to a zero-G space girlfriend. And it cuts off, like... I can't remember the words exactly, but she's like, I've got something important to tell you.
Yeah.
And then she dies. And it's like, that's not anything that ever resolves or anything, but it's just like, how is that going to affect Holden? Like, that is not a good thing to hear.
Yeah. And he also says, she's gone at that moment, which could be taken, you know, to the rest of the crew, probably meant the ship's gone. But to him, it was like...
Well, I think Naomi kind of spots... Naomi spots that he... Like, yeah, he could mean the ship, but I think Naomi spots that he means her. He means specifically
yeah,
her.
Yeah, and she meant more to him than he meant to her. Typical. Anyway, let's look into that.
I think that's what the... I've got something to tell you. I think that was going to be a, like, I didn't mean what I love. Of course I love you, like, but I was just being...
Or it could mean that she's pregnant, or... that was another thing. Anyway, that it doesn't get resolved, so let's not go
down
that
rabbit hole. But the point is that, like, it could
he's never going to know. Because the other thing, I don't know if you caught this, Chris, but they weren't expecting the ship to be destroyed.
No.
They weren't expecting nuclear missiles to hit it and, you know... wipe it out. They were expecting it to be damaged so that somebody could steal their stuff. You know, they didn't expect wholesale annihilation of the ship.
So a nuke. So that's a literal nuke. That was a weapon of war.
Those were nuclear tipped missiles.
That's the kind of like dirty corporation something. But also, there's political intrigue, isn't there? So are we supposed to like be like, well, is this part of the political intrigue? Is this shady corporation? That's the mystery that we're kicking off.
Well, there, right? the thread that connects the incident with Canterbury and some of the intrigue we've already seen is stealth technology. The ship that attacks them is a stealth ship.
And they didn't see it coming. It came out of nowhere.
Yeah, because it was able to evade the sensors. So the only other time we've heard anything about stealth technology was when Avasarala is
UN lady.
When Avasarala is interrogating the prisoner who's hung up on the wall. That's the only other time we hear that in the first episode.
So evil corporation is stoking Mars against not Mars is stoking Outer Rim against Earth, UN.
The only thing we can take from it is from the first episode that is Avasarala is going to think that it was the OPA because she's investigating the OPA for being caught with stealth technology. That's the only thing we could infer, really.
Probably going to infer that the OPA and Mars are working together.
Yeah,
because stealth technology is a big deal, but the OPA is just like Antifa.
They do say in the first episode only Mars has stealth technology.
The three parts. So I forgot to mention the Mars, but sorry. Yeah, so stealth technology is a Martian technology. She thinks the OPA, well, she's caught the OPA with it, and then this incident happens where a stealth ship destroys a transport.
The colonial agreements between Earth and Mars about getting all the thing, about getting the air and water from the planets, that's in jeopardy. Like that, because they talk about the treaty that they're going to be signing, which presumably is some kind of like divvying up of the resources on the asteroid belt, right?
Mm.
And because so what someone might be doing.
If I could just interject slightly. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is going to affect what you're saying or what you're thinking, but the ice was on its way to the belt. They were collecting the ice from the asteroid belt to take it to it was going to Ceres in particular.
I mean, possibly for redistribution later, though. It probably goes to Ceres and then on to the inner planet. Some of it used on Ceres, so...
But Ceres needs it more desperately than Mars or Earth does, is the point.
Oh, but so that's, that, Ceres that... is so Ceres is a place on the asteroid belt, right?
Well, Ceres is an asteroid. Oh, sorry. I just assume everybody knows about the astronomy of the solar system when we're talking about this. Oh, I did this with somebody else who's watching. I said, "Yeah, Ganymede. Was that a real planet? Yeah, it's one of the moons of Jupiter." You know, Ceres is a large asteroid in the asteroid belt.
And has it been like fully exploited? Is it a mining asteroid that's been fully exploited?
Basically, that's why the people there are complaining that there's, you know, they've got water and their rations when. They had all the water on Ceres to start with.
Okay. And so they're not... Are they using Ceres as any kind of launching pad to mine elsewhere?
Yeah.
There are other mining places. Yeah. Ceres, because they've already mined it out, basically, Ceres is now just a big spaceport in the belt.
The relationship between Earth and Mars, this is stuff that you learn later, but it's not spoilery, and it's kind of, you know, it's present from the beginning. So Mars has always been dependent on Earth because, you know, while they're setting up, they need resources from Earth, obviously.
Yeah.
But Earth is kind of nervous that relationship is coming to an end, that they're terrified of Mars becoming self-sufficient and turning against Earth. That haunts, you know, the Earthers.
But also Earth is quite populated, right? Is it overpopulated?
It's the impression, again, this comes later, but the impression you get is that you were explicitly told there aren't enough jobs for everybody. So there's an underclass living on UBI, basically, and there's too many people for the work. They're still capitalists, so, you know, there's billionaires and there's the masses on UBI, basically, and the lucky few who manage to get a job.
Okay, so a three-tier class system, then?
Yeah.
So aristocracy, merchant class...
capitalist, bourgeoisie, and proletariat, but the proletariat don't have jobs.
Yeah. Okay, cool. One thing I did notice is that, and I'm sorry if I pay too much attention to these things, but it was 48 minutes is for the episode one. How consistent are the episode length times? Because usually with the first episode of a series, it's longer. But this is quite short for an episode.
Yeah, I was quite surprised actually how much this fit in. It's pretty much 45 minutes, 47 minutes, whatever an American hour is or whatever on TV.
An American hour.
It varies between 45 minutes and an hourish.
But part of that's because the production and company changed partway through the run. The show got cancelled by one lot and then picked up. For the rest of it,
so it was sci-fi originally, and they dropped it, and there was a fan petition, and Amazon picked it up and finished it off.
Yeah, so there is actually a bit of a difference between the number of episodes and length of episodes going through the series. So yeah, you can't rely on one series being exactly the same as the next.
But it's roughly
45 minutes an hour. Yeah.
Yeah.
All episodes. So yeah, it means when I was watching it, I actually did check that what you just mentioned is like, oh, this the first episode is a double. I thought they fit so much into 45 minutes.
There's a lot to. I mean, I had to watch it twice to sort of like get a, you know, get my head around it.
Because
it's nice
to watch it twice.
Yeah,
I like
that's
that.
Good. That's good.
Yeah. There's one to sink into it and enjoy it as an audience member, and then another to like. Work out the bits that I want to focus.
Yeah, as I said, that's why I bounce off it. I think it was like, there's a bit too much here. I'm a bit confused. So, I'll come back to it later. So I did end up watching it multiple times at work before it clicked. Yeah,
like it's definite, like, I mean, I'm obviously confused because they've best laid the foundations of a mystery.
Yeah, if you worked out the mystery in the first episode, it wouldn't be much worth it.
Well, it's not just one mystery. Like, you've identified the corporate stuff, the geopolitical stuff. I'm going to call it geopolitical, even that means I don't want to be. But again, the film noir, like Miller is such a, he's so specifically and exactly film noir without it ever feeling like a pastiche or weird. Because he's just concerned with this missing girl, right? Yeah. She's kind of in the film where she's kind of the femme fatale. She's kind of, you know, the woman in the red dress who comes in with a mystery and then he finds out she's killed. That's, you know, that's the common sort of trope. But he's so exactly that without it ever not quite fitting in. But I think he's a little bit self-awarely that, I think. I think he leans into it and I think that helps. Yeah. Like, the character is not unaware that he's filling this trope kind of thing.
Mm. Yeah, no, I kind of definitely got the vibe that they were leaning into it for sure.
Mm.
But then that is like, that's where the Blade Runner feel came from for me.
Well, that and his boss is definitely a very Blade Runner type relationship, you know?
I would say more happens than in Blade Runner.
Or more happens in episode one than happens in Blade Runner.
I'm totally but I do pick up the aesthetic. The vibes, I guess. You know, the riffing of almost like a what's the word I'm thinking of? It's obviously doing a lot of homaging. I think it's always
because there's a line between homage and pastiche, and I think it stays on the homage side without ever feeling like a pastiche.
Yeah, and because it doesn't jar with the other stuff that's got a bit of homage to it either. Never does, even though it comes together in various places. It doesn't feels organic still.
That's what I meant about the, like, you've got the film noir layers, you've got the happy crew of space adventurers layer, then later on you've got other layers that pile on top of that, and they all intersect without ever feeling like, because it could be seven different shows. But it never feels jarring when the two things meet up. It feels incredibly satisfying, actually.
Yeah, it does. It's amazingly
satisfying.
You're very, very happy when you get to exactly, revelations of things. You're like, this is nobody just go turns up or says something off screen and it resolves something or anything. It all happens all the way through it. And you
kind of, over time, obviously, you develop like favorite characters and characters. You know, I kind of love all of them. Like, Avasaral is amazing. I think my very two top favorites, though, are Amos, as you come to learn more about him, and Bobby, who you've not met yet.
This is the thing. When I was talking to my friend who's watching it with me, I was like, series two, Bobby's in. We started on series two, and it's like, Bobby's in it, she's great. And of course, at the beginning, you don't really see why.
No, exactly.
And it's like, I better not spoil anything and tell you anything.
I think on my first rewatch, I was like, this is the episode where Bobby turns up. This is going to be amazing. But like, Bobby doesn't really become Bobby until like a season later.
Towards the end of the second series, she becomes what she sort of is.
Yeah,
you know, her.
There's one moment that I mentioned to you, I think, in text, Hamish. There's one moment. It's my absolute favorite moment of the show, and that involves Bobby. And I'm deeply in love with Bobby.
Oh yeah, she's great. You don't know. Yeah, sorry. We're talking about episode one with Chris, and then we're talking about things that he's never going to see for a long time.
This is kind of great because of what we said. Bobby's going to turn up, and Chris is going to be like, "She's not that amazing. Why do you love her so much?" And that's going to be cool.
Yeah, it'll take you a while to get to where we are. I think it's inevitable that we know the characters all the way through. So it's really hard for us to not.
That's totally okay.
At the same time as you're watching it from the beginning, you know.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I kind of like that guidance because it helps me know where my head should be at, if that makes sense.
Which is going to change your experience, I think, to some degree. But that, you know, that's what it is. You know.
It's the sort of foreknowledge that you know certain people are not going to die. It's like talking about Game of Thrones. You know, no character was safe in Game of Thrones, basically.
If we knew each other in real life, we'd be watching this on the couch together and we'd be having this exact experience.
Yeah, exactly.
It's great. Watch out.
I hate to tell you this, Drew, but this is actually real. It's just remote. We are real people.
Not AI.
Yeah, it's actual people. This isn't a hallucination. I'm really looking forward to doing more of this because the more you start to learn, the more excited it's going to become for us.
Joy,
as well.
Right, is you know, vicariously experiencing it again through Chris, through fresh eyes. It's lovely.
Yeah. I mean, the thing,
his theories and stuff, and going,
here's a problem that I kind of foresee, and let's knock it out while I remember. Right, here's the thing, right? So if we're doing this, like you, it's like you alluded to, maybe like fortnightly or something like that, right? I'm not going to be able to watch one episode like, and just leave it at that for a fortnight, right? One episode of four. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. So, I know.
And also, there's going to be, is it going to be too slow a pace to, like, are we just going to be combing over every, where, what I could do, by the time we do the next one, I could have just watched season one. I could probably that's stop at that.
Probably a lot more, there's probably more to talk about over maybe two or three episodes than there is over the whole series.
What about half a series? What about season five?
I think this is going to be a better thing to watch if you can make yourself go over the episode.
Is it worth it? Much
is revealed and added in each episode that I think, yeah, we're not going to get like a clean read or whatever.
Exactly. Yep. As you learn something new, we want to sort of enjoy that.
rather than watching ahead, keep rewatching the episode your homework has assigned you.
Okay.
If you can, I know that's going to be hard. I probably wouldn't be able to do that.
No, I wouldn't.
but try your best not to go ahead, I would say.
Is there weekly
then to make that easier to avoid?
Yeah, weekly would be the sort of standard thing, wouldn't it, for a TV?
I could try and do weekly. My schedule might be mixing up it over the week. So have we got some flexibility on maybe time and day?
Oh yeah, because my sleep pattern rotate, so it's not going to be possible for me to do it at the same time every week. But yeah, if we just sort of each week, we should probably do this off air, right?
Let's finish this.
I will say so far, and this is part of why I want you to keep to one episode at a time, your question every time you ask a question, you're like, this might be a weird thing to ask a question about, but that it's your questions are great. That's exactly
what
they
I have
want
been good like questions you. Yeah,
this thing,
we're not saying yes or no to your theories, but we are enjoying your questions.
You're going to pick up on slightly different things to what we're going to pick up on, because we've seen it all before. So the things you choose to ask questions about is great. I love it.
It's very exciting watching it with somebody. As I say, I recently started watching it from scratch with a friend. But we did watch two or three episodes at a time, you know, like have some food and watch two or three episodes of an evening and then, you know, so forth. It'll be
easier if they're closer to an hour, because there's more to digest, and because I'll try and get at least two watches in, so I know, you know, one to enjoy it, one to work, you know.
It's a very rewatchable show as well.
It's
very dense, and you notice different things each time. I'm still noticing new things.
Well, like I said earlier, it only just clicked to me when you mentioned about Holden actually deliberately doing that, and then Chris pointing out, yeah, that seemed a bit weird, and it's like, oh yeah, now that makes more sense with those two viewpoints put together. Yeah,
we might be wrong. We might be overreading in, but
maybe.
That slotted it in quite.
And that's kind of what I mean about rewatching is such a joy, because there's so much that little things that don't make sense until you know what you know at the end, or not at the end, but you know much further on. There's so many things, not just like things they set up and then resolve later, but just little character details that you're like, oh, that's why this later on. That's why you made this decision rather than that decision.
I think they made it very interesting to have the first scene that they did with Julia on the spaceship, and it's like it takes a while for that to pay off, but it's very important, and I don't often like things that come out of sequence, but it's not actually out of sequence temporarily, it's out of sequence for what we get revealed, and
this show, I will say, like, you know there's the mystery box shows where it's just like it never gets satisfyingly resolved, or often not resolved at all. This show never does that. Everything resolves. Everything has a purpose that they knew from the beginning.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So what can you, what is the time, like, the, in terms of the time frame? I've got two questions. Right. How sequential are we talking?
I would say everything you're seeing is sequential, apart from Julie Mao stuff.
Okay.
Well, not temporarily,
but in roughly, like, Miller investigating Julie Mao's disappearance is happening at roughly the same time as what you're seeing on the Canterbury.
Yeah.
Whereas the scenes you're seeing with Julie Mao in the container,
it's sort of a slight flashback, I would say.
That's a bit before, I think.
Yeah, but not massively, okay. I don't think, time wise.
No.
It's not happening at the same time because of, well, you find out later why it couldn't be at the same time.
okay, but you're
while they're starting to put the they're trying to put the story together of what's happening, you know. Hmm.
But broadly chronological, it's not going to, because sometimes shows will deliberately put things in an awkward order so that they've got that.
I hate when they do it for the sake of it, yeah. There's only one big flashback point, and that's in series two, and that's because they're explaining a bit of human Earth-Mars history with a bit of technology that happened in the past. That's the only real flashback I've seen.
Oh, I just remembered what you...
Yeah, I forgot his name. Epstein, is it?
Epstein.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I remember being an actual
flashback, but it makes sense. And it's not, like, confusing. They say this happened in the past.
We're told
it's 137 years ago or whatever it is, this thing happens. And it kind of... Yeah, it kind of explains how Mars kind of got to be sort of weirdly separated technologically from Earth as well, yeah. Anyway, I'm not going to get into that because that's a long way off.
Okay. All right. I think I've got. I quite like actually the discussion side of this because it does give me like a bit of like, it gives me context that in terms of like the sides and the things. Like I feel like I've got a better understanding of the world going into episode two, and I feel more like if I was just watching this on my own. I think I would be very overwhelmed with.
I think that's what Drew was saying. It's not an easy watch from the start until you get to a few episodes in, and
but you folks are making it easier. So I think this might be I feel a lot more comfortable with the lore than I was coming on to. Well, when we started recording.
Well, excellent. Yeah, I'm not really a big fan of shows that people say, "Oh, you've got to watch a few episodes for it to make sense." That quite often is a very bad sign for me, but with this, I think because of the sheer scope of it helps. Because it gets bigger and bigger, but you see all the threads of it from the start.
And it shows,
a starting point, obviously, people's
life. In terms of on the part of the people who made this show, it demonstrates such because, like I say, I bounced off it twice. I knew there was something there I was interested in, but it took me three attempts to actually get into it. And that's because, like I said at the beginning, you could just, as I did, you can just sort of say, "Oh, this is just film noir in space," but they were confident enough to not because they could have done sort of flashbacky stuff or flash forwardy stuff that shows you the stakes earlier on to get you hooked. They didn't do that. They just set it up, you know, bit by bit. They set it up and then let the when it all comes together, because they made that choice, it's such a payoff. And then you're like, I want to go back and watch, you know, what led to this.
I like the way that way around, because sometimes in fact it's like the opposite of The Witcher, right, where they have the big grand moment at the beginning.
Exactly
And then it sort of all leads up to it, and it's like, right, you've shown me the thing that I'm invested in right off the bat, whereas this sort of, it expects you to, do a little
work. Yeah. Well, the only thing they show you up front is the bit with Julie,
which makes no sense for a while. Yeah, but I will say it's different because I agree. This show, when I recommend it to people, I say you've got to get to about episode four before it really kicks off, and then season two is where it starts becoming what it really is, right?
Which is
a hard thing to tell to somebody who's just starting to watch it.
Yeah.
But that's different from like other shows where it's like, oh, see, like TNG season one's just shit. The Sopranos, and there's a lot of shows where they take a bit of time to work out who these characters are, what they're, you know, how to present them on, even if it's come from a book. So like The Sopranos season one is definitely weaker than other seasons, you know. The Office, you know, is the American Office, but it's not difficult in that way. It's difficult in that they have the confidence to just like not patronize their audience and let the things pay off in the way they should pay
off. And let it all move. Well, I keep using the word organic, but I think that's the best way to put it.
The first bit with the thing that I know I'm not supposed to understand it, but like the bit at the beginning sort of to me is a bit like the beginning of Game of Thrones, where they go beyond the wall with the prologue.
Yeah, well, that's a fairly good comparison,
It almost to that point feels. I don't know if I'm sort of assuming a lot of knowledge here, but it does feel like, because the writer from this comes from the same thing as George R. R. Martin, like as in there's like a commonality, there's a link. It might be a bit homage-y, in that regard to having the sort of that.
It's not what the whole show's about, though. That the payoff from that is not the entire show. Because it's a very character-y show.
I won't get into Game of Thrones criticism, but I will. Mm-hmm. I will say this is a better show overall than Game of Thrones. Like, it doesn't do what Game of Thrones does at the end.
Yeah.
Also, I think Game of Thrones has a weakness all the way through in that it was very good at setting up archetypal characters and then putting those archetypal characters in entertaining combinations, but it didn't really have anything else. Whereas this show has that plus a ton of other stuff.
And we're just so excited that you're going to watch it. It's so good when somebody else gets into it.
When I was trying to get you to watch it previously, Chris, I think I described it as like it's like the best of Game of Thrones in space, because it does have that like political intrigue stuff going on.
I've never been the biggest sci-fi person, but the thing about sci-fi that has the thing that I wanted to like about sci-fi the most is the Star Trek-y politics in space, because it's so it takes a lot of ideas, but because it abstracts them into this world, you sort of can have a bit more fun with them without having to over, like, you get it also with medieval fantasy, but with medieval fantasy it is in history and ergo context and culture and all that kind of thing, whereas I think space is a bit more like you've got a bit more like free reign. Like, I mean, in Star Wars, the world of Star Wars, there's very, very few cultural hooks into our world anyway. But it certainly,
Star Wars is a weird one, because there are, you know, in a sense, it's a samurai film in space, it's a western in space, it's a fantasy film in space. It's all of those things. But in terms of, you mean in terms of the world itself, you don't
the
have
world the itself. Yeah,
yeah.
The Earth reference that I think I've ever heard is on one occasion Harrison Ford says they can go to hell, and I think it's like I think if my Star Wars trivia is true, I think that might be intentional, but I don't know why. Like,
I'll see you in hell.
He says it in when he's going out in the Tauntaun to find Luke and the Empire Strikes Back. You'll freeze before your Tauntaun will freeze before you reach the first marker. Then I'll see you in hell. That's what. Sorry to be super nerdy.
That's exactly what I was saying.
Like sci-fi has sort of like three-ish broad. You know, you've got your sort of space adventure sci-fi. You know, your Star Wars. You've got your Star Trek, which sort of rides the line between hard sci-fi and space adventure. And then you've got your hard, you know, your very hard sci-fi, existential ideas and philosophical ideas and stuff. And The Expanse does all of those.
Kind of does throw it all in,
I mean, not to get too much into the film sort of thing discussion, but I mean, a lot of people don't think of Star Wars as a sci-fi at all.
I think that's a bit of a bullshitty thing to say. It clearly is in some sense sci-fi, but it shares more characteristics with the sci-fi is a setting rather than
there's no hard sci-fi in it. You know, it's very inconsistent and everything. It's all about set pieces, really. Star Wars, almost all of it is about set pieces and spectacle.
My rule of Star Wars is, for the love of God, don't take it seriously. It's a vibes-based show. You just, like, you enjoy the fun, bouncy, silly robots in space. You enjoy the little micro stories or the, you know, and if you can...
Yeah, no, as soon as Star Wars gets serious, it becomes very evident how thin that, because of what you have thin that was. Whereas I came to Star Trek very late. As a kid, I grew up in the 70s and 80s, right? So I grew up with all the toys were Star Wars. Our playing imaginative landscape was always, you know, Star Wars involved. And then the prequels happened and killed it. I always disdained Star Trek as like a boring, nerdy show where they just fucking talk. And I think I used to take the piss out of my flatmate for liking Star Trek. And then I think it wasn't until my 20s that I was like, because I one thing I like doing is watching things that I think I don't like to either see why people like them or even better end up enjoying them. And I watched Star Trek in my 20s and I love it now. Star Trek's amazing because it has that, you know, that ensemble cast of characters trying to solve with good intentions in an optimistic world, trying to solve problems together. And I love that. And The Expanse has it's not an analog of Star Trek by any means, but it has that aspect of Star Trek.
It does have the little bubble where there's the crew that do that.
Yeah, but it also has the adventure of Star Wars as well.
Mm. Yeah. I gotta be honest, and I don't know if you're gonna slaughter me for this one, but I always think of Star Trek, and I don't know if this is an age thing, whether or not with Next Generation, because it's so iconic. I almost think of the Next Generation as like the Lord of the Rings of sci-fi, in terms of like it's sort of set the tone. The number of video games that have completely based so much stuff on the Next Generation or Star Trek, references to things like Red Shirts, and even
I see what you're saying, but at the same time, there's nothing else like Star Trek, which has always been the weird thing. Nothing can seem to manage that optimistic. The closest thing to Star Trek is The West Wing.
I don't. Okay. That doesn't make sense at all to me. I mean,
it's characters with good intentions trying to make the world better and solving problems by talking, you know, trying to do it diplomatically and talking them through rather than, you know, conflict.
Yeah, but with Star Trek Next Generation, there is also so many what ifs, right? That's a lot of sci-fi, isn't it? It's like, what if there was a world? What if there was a planet with only two people living on it? Or what if there was a computer that ate all the other computers?
I mean, if you want to go TOS, what if there was a planet where the two races were single people that were
half white and half black? No, he's half black, half white. I'm half black, half white, half black.
Yeah, it's like that.
Is this about racism?
And they did it better than the Bewitched racism episode. I don't know if you've there's a Bewitched episode of race, you know, where they're exploring racism, where they just become black.
Is this Julie Andrews Bewitched? Audrey Hepburn?
No.
Man,
TV show Man Marries Witch.
Yeah, suburban basically.
Witch becomes 1960s suburban.
She twitches her nose to
that's, the... Yeah. Who was that? Who's the actor?
I forgot
her name now, yeah.
Very famous, but I forget her name.
They changed. Was it the husband that changed?
Yeah.
Yeah, husband changed. Anyway, this is... I'm wondering when I should have stopped recording at this point.
I think the meandering is part of the point.
Yeah, fine.
I mean, the thing is, I'm not as familiar with sci-fi as I am with other music, with other genres.
I lean more fantasy than I do sci-fi, but I think sci-fi is usually better.
I tend to like the harder sci-fi more. Mm. You know, on you go, mate. Yeah.
So I love the distinct, the sort of almost like medieval fantasy and sci-fi are like opposites to me, with like medieval stuff reduces the size of a world often through like restricting technology or restricting, you know, that kind of thing. Whereas sci-fi does the opposite. It makes everything super, super, super big. And then
what you're saying is sci-fi is kind of like an expanse.
Yeah. Hey. So with sci-fi you can have so much more like complicatedness, and there is sometimes a lot of satisfaction in that and comprehensiveness, but also sometimes like brevity is the soul of wit, and sometimes something simple just slots together well can also be quite satisfying, and you get that with like medieval stuff. And also one of the things as well that I have noticed is that women that I know who are big into, like, should we say, like the whole nerdy stuff, a lot of them often quite are a lot more attracted to sci-fi because there is like this, like there is this optimism of you know, like well, like with like there's an egalitarianism and optimism with sci-fi, whereas of course,
well, I would say not necessarily optimism so much as like possibility.
Yeah. Whereas with medieval society, it's like, well, it's patriarchal. Mm. It's more backwards. It's like, it's a lot more like violence is a big thing. Whereas often with sci-fi, like violence is difficult because it works differently in space. Do guns even work in space? Probably not.
They do. Yeah.
I don't know. They do. Oh, right.
Yeah.
But the violence in sci-fi is determined by exactly how the world is built. How powerful are the space lasers? Can they tear a ship in half, or is it just going to take a couple of health down? Like, so I guess.
Well, I think the Expanse is essentially it's a bit like new Battlestar Galactica, and that they eschew sort of, you know, things that are not very practical in reality. So it is, you know, physical weapons like nuclear tipped missiles and things like that. So yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I do have a question about the science. I don't know if you're able to answer this. So is the gravity in Ceres centrifugal force based? So
in the fiction, a corporation spun Ceres on its axis in order to kind of to show off that they're a good engineering company and they should be trusted for the belt. I've read it. I don't do this very often, but I read into this a little bit, and the consensus seems to be that is ridiculously impractical. Mm. Like, it would take an absurd amount of energy to do that. But in the fiction of the show, Ceres is spinning because a corporation spun it up. Which means that the gravity varies. So in the wealthier places, the gravity is more like Earth, and then you get to the poorer places, and the gravity is a bit wonky, and you will see that.
Right, okay. Because the thing is, right, and maybe this is me asking a stupid question now, but
no stupid questions.
It's not the reason why planets have gravity is because of they're a big mass, they are spinning, the spinning...
No, most of gravity comes down to mass.
You're right, but yeah, when you get down to like general relativity, it's like part of the point is like it's all the fucking same, and we don't really understand why. Okay.
That's why gravity hasn't been unified with the rest of stuff. You know,
the gravity is it centripetal or centrifuge? But yeah, that's down to acceleration. So that's the same as if you're in a ship that's going, you know, it's accelerating upwards, you feel gravity downwards.
What the thing in the SpaceX is.
Yeah, that's just the thrust of the ship. Thrust. Did the Earth move for you? No, but the ship did, you know.
Okay. Like, now, one of the things that I've been told about this is the science is supposed to hold up under scrutiny.
Mostly it does, yeah. It's
mostly
pretty good.
With you know, with various sci-fi.
Well, you're talking about the, for example, the gravity thing. Is that you notice it in the first episode right away? They all have magnetic boots.
I will say they're never a slave. I think some sci-fi is a slave to the science and technology to the point where it becomes. There's a particular. I tried to read. Was it Seven Eves, the one where the moon blows up in seven parts? And the author just explains how every piece of fucking technology works for like page after page. And I'm like, that's not my kind of, so I'm not interested in that. So they never do that. But it is, it's all plausible.
Plausible science. Okay. Drew was saying, there's some stuff that doesn't quite hold up as how. You know, how do they have gravity in Ceres?
Asimov-y, actually. The Asimov that I've read, which is mostly Foundation and bits of others, Asimov never really gets into how the technology works, but it's always... you can tell he's thought about how it works, but he never, like, explains it. It's just sort of... It's there and it's plausible.
Okay, that's interesting. That's kind of like you get the best of both worlds then. You get something... Because I should be querying technology.
To some extent that way. Because they do... Yeah. The physics of reality comes into play a lot, especially when they're travelling and when they're trying to manoeuvre in space. Well, you saw it in the... In the first episode, they've got this thing where they have to be strapped in and have drugs pumped into their body to survive the the acceleration.
That's a bit hand wavy, right?
Yeah, that's a wee bit hand wavy, but
it's like so they can survive. There's a lovely bit in I love episode 4 of season 1. So that's for me, that was one of the turning points. There's a lovely bit in episode, I think it's in episode 4, where Hamish will get what I'm talking about, I think, where there's a zero G situation, and I think Holden kicks Naomi, and then physics happens. And it's like, oh god, yeah, they understand physics. Like the people writing them understand how physics works, and that's nice.
I think another bit you mean, yeah.
on a gantry, if that helps.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I definitely know what bit you mean. Yeah, I can't remember what episode it is, but you're right, it's somewhere in the middle.
Well, cool. All right, have we explored it?
I think we've
explored the expanse. Yeah.
I think all my questions have been answered or sufficiently waved away.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't want to spoil it, but we do want to help you along. Yeah.
So, no, if anybody comments on this, suggest a name.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
Or should we continue being name
three
goes
blokes
here?
Talking about the expansion?
No, there's too many podcasts called Name Goes Here. It will just.
Yeah, that'd be silly.
Normal podcast, apart from we forgot the woman.
We'll come up with a name for the next one.
Well, like, there's a challenge you've just set yourself.
That's a bold promise.
Yeah, you've got the episodes two episodes, you know, first and second episodes to watch again.
Yeah, I'll take that away as my homework. I mean, I'll fire off ideas to you, of course, but I'll.
Where are we posting this as well? That probably matters. Are we posting it on your YouTube, or are we making a new channel on my main one for it, or what?
Oh my god!
Because if we are making a new channel for it on my main one, it needs a name. But we can worry about that.
With PeerTube, what you can do is
you can link to more than one thing, can't you?
Yeah. Well, if you're recording it, then it might as well go up on. You might as well upload it then to PeerTube, but what you can do is you can upload it to your main video channel, and then once we've come up with a name, you can move the video over to another channel.
Yeah, how about this is definitely admin, so should we end it there?
Yeah, let's stop the recording.
Thank you for watching Name Goes Here. See you next time.
Name Goes Here.
Possibly with a name. Bye.